is going to be talking on an internal investigation, satisfaction guarantee, devising an internal investigation that will satisfy everyone from the business unit to the jury room. The panel consists of Zara Karinchak, Kelly Kennedy, Steve Pines, and Jim Reed.
Good afternoon. We subtitled this Devising an Internal Investigation That Will Satisfy Everyone from the Business Unit to the Jury. But that, of course, is somewhat tongue-in-cheek because there is no such animal. At the end of any investigation, someone's going to be unhappy, whether it's the complainant, whether it's the accused. What our presentation today is going to focus on is trying to make sure that at the end of the investigation, it's not you or your client that's unhappy. So we're going to start with an overview of some of the problematic areas that investigators can encounter during the course of an investigation. My particular practice is an interesting blend of about 75% employment litigation defense and about 25% independent investigations. So I have the opportunity to see these investigations both coming and going and to see the problems that can come up on either end. The most common problems that we see during the course of these investigations involve choosing the right investigator, some legal and ethical traps that can come up for inexperienced investigators, making appropriate findings for the investigation, attorney-client and work product issues, avoiding disruption and controlling costs internally if you're in-house counsel, implementing solutions when you're done that will allow people to continue to work together, allow the business to continue to run. And finally, if the unfortunate circumstance arises that you actually have to take one of these cases to trial, defending the investigation. So we decided that the easiest way to present this material to you would be to start with a pop quiz. So we're going to go through a hypothetical fact pattern. And the fact pattern is actually an amalgamation of cases that I have actually handled as either an investigator or as defense counsel. So all of the facts you're going to see in this fact pattern actually occurred in some case. And what we'd like you to do is, as we're going through the fact pattern, see if you can identify the mistakes that are made. So the facts are these. Super salesman Bob works with receptionist Rita. Rita begins dating maintenance man Marty. One day, Marty drags Rita into human resources and states that she wants to make a complaint of sexual harassment against Bob. Marty claims that Bob has been sending Rita suggestive texts and making sexual comments to her. HR manager Betty asks Rita if this is true. Rita agrees that it is, but states she doesn't want to get Bob in trouble. Marty demands that Bob be fired. Betty asks Rita to make a written complaint and gives her a form to fill out. Rita fills out the form, indicating that Bob has been making sexual comments and sending suggestive texts. Marty shows some of the texts to Betty. Rita asks Betty what the next steps will be. Betty tells Rita the company will conduct an investigation. Betty cautions Rita that the investigation is completely confidential and that Rita cannot speak to anyone about her complaint or the investigation. If she does, she will be subject to discipline. Betty calls the company's in-house counsel, who tells her to ask Bob's manager, Mike, to conduct the investigation. Mike reviews Rita's complaint form and a printout of the text messages from Bob. He then interviews Bob and asks if the allegations are true. Bob admits that they are, but claims that he and Rita have had an on-again, off-again romantic relationship for the past 2 years, a fact of which Marty is unaware. Bob shows Mike his own cell phone, which belongs to the company and which contains numerous sexual messages to and from Rita. Some of the texts from Rita include nude pictures. Bob also volunteers to bring in pictures of he and Rita on vacation in Disneyland. Bob also claims during the interview that Marty has been making racist comments to him and has a large racist tattoo on his back. Mike interviews Marty. During the interview, he asks if Marty is aware of the relationship between Bob and Rita. Marty admits he is not. Mike also asks Marty if he has a racist tattoo on his back. Marty denies having the tattoo. Mike asks Marty to take off his shirt so he can see his back. Marty asks if he has to. Mike tells him yes. Marty takes off his shirt, revealing a tattooless back. Mike then determines that Bob has not engaged in sexual harassment since he and Rita have had a consensual relationship. Mike determines that Marty has not engaged in racial harassment since he has no tattoo on his back. Mike determines that since Rita sent Bob inappropriate pictures on company property and company time, she should be disciplined. So, how many mistakes were made during the course of this investigation? For those of you who were following along, did people identify 5 mistakes? 6?
I saw some big smiles over here about the tattoo, so I was wondering if somebody over here had some experience with that, or anyone wanted to comment?
All right. So there were at least 10 mistakes made during the course of this investigation. What were those mistakes? We're going to talk about those now. And really, I say mistakes, but any one of these mistakes might not necessarily be a mistake in every particular investigation. Really, what we want to talk about is best practices. And if you practice in certain jurisdictions, particularly California, where employment cases are increasingly seeing the use of employment law experts, including expert investigators, there is now becoming a standard of care for investigations. There's a National Association of Workplace Investigators that has promulgated guiding principles for performing internal investigations, and those guiding principles are now being cited increasingly by experts in court cases as the standard of care for conducting independent investigations. And so the mistakes that were made in this case have to do with the choice of the investigator, the admonitions that were or were not given, interviewing the witnesses, confidentiality and privacy violations, and finally the findings that were made. And so, Steve, you're going to talk to us about choosing the right investigator.
That's right. Certainly you're not going to be satisfied. No one's going to be satisfied if you choose the wrong investigator. And there are a number of choices. We're going to consider first, if you're looking outside the company, choosing someone from outside the company, and then we'll look about choosing inside as well. But there's been interesting developments here. So first, what happened in this particular fact pattern? In this case, the human resource director asked in-house counsel who should be conducting this. The answer was Mike, who is the manager of the super salesman. This has got to be our first mistake, because choosing Mike as the manager of the super salesman to investigate claims against Mike immediately invokes a problem of bias. Mike, the manager, is going to want to save his super salesman if there's any way possible. And so why is it important to choose the investigator properly? So that the results of the investigation can be relied upon by the company. If you have results that are unreliable, that's going to be a problem and be discussed further on in our presentation. And what ought to be considered as you select someone who's going to conduct this investigation? Certainly, the circumstances of what's to be investigated, the experience of the investigator, how much liability is involved. One of the matters that will be discussed later on by counsel here, in-house counsel here, is the cost that have to be considered as well. All of these factors will go into choosing who the investigator should be. And as you enter into those choices, first looking from the outside here on the slide, first and probably in many cases a best choice would be an independent, licensed, private investigator. And just interestingly, I was speaking to an investigator that I use regularly, a private investigator in San Diego, and he told me that in the paper yesterday there was a headline about an accountant who worked for a company, been working for the company for, I believe he said, 5 years, and they had admitted that they had taken $500,000. So it's sometimes important to do a little background checking. And as part of the investigation, if you retain a private investigator, they will do the that background checking. And in this case, it appears that the woman who is the accused in this instance indicated that the reason that she had stolen the $500,000 was to pay off a restitution requirement from her former employer, where she had embezzled $500,000. So that about takes the cake. Now, additionally, if you're not going to use a private investigator, you might go to a human resource professional. There is a whole class of investigators that are sort of developing among human resource professionals who are familiar with the practices and the law, applicable law, and that for various companies, they will conduct investigations. And as they conduct these investigations, they are familiar with the process and the procedures, and so that they can prepare a very reasonable report. If you're not going that route, another possibility would be to have independent counsel conduct an investigation. And I contrast that with the next one, which is regular counsel. Oftentimes, a business will have counsel that they use on an ongoing basis for various reasons. Sometimes they may want to engage the services of that counsel to conduct an investigation. That may be a problem, though, and so an alternate approach would be to retain yet another counsel, a separate counsel, to conduct that investigation. This was particularly highlighted just recently, actually a few days ago, in a case that involved, it's entitled EEOC versus Spitzer Management, Inc. It's up in the Northern District of California, Northern District of Ohio. And there in the Spitzer case, the regular counsel was used to conduct an investigation. And the notes, in particular, as they went forward, there was discovery, and the notes were requested. The notes of the investigation from counsel were requested. The notes were not produced. A transcript of the notes from the investigation was produced. And eventually, there was all kinds of argument regarding these notes, and did they have to be produced? Ultimately, the court said, well, if these are the notes that were relied on, they have to be produced. They were produced, and there were three words on the notes that were not found in the printed transcript. And those three words were, "Bad for us." With that notation, which they hoped to assert an attorney-client privilege, obviously, maybe not so obviously to them at the time, it was waived, and so they did have to produce that, and that came into the case. Now, what's so interesting about this is that because of this process, the court in that case, what happened just recently, is the court ordered sanctions against the company and the attorney for $300,000, which was the estimated attorney's fees that have been spent just trying to get these notes produced. So oftentimes, if the case merits it, you probably want to consider, instead of using regular counsel, using separate independent counsel to conduct an investigation if you want an attorney to conduct that investigation. And the benefit of that is the attorney who conducts the investigation, there'll be a privilege there which can be waived and the facts will come in, whereas your regular attorney who may be advising you may maintain that privilege of advising you about what the facts mean for your particular case. All right. Going on, if you're going to choose someone from inside the company, then you may want to consider the various choices. There may be in-house counsel who could conduct the investigation. This is probably not a great choice, but in some cases where maybe the issues aren't as large as they might otherwise be, it might make sense to use in-house counsel. Another possibility would be to use someone from the Human Resources Department. The greater likelihood that they have had more opportunity to experience investigations of these type on an ongoing basis, and there may be some consistency in having someone in-house Human Resources perform the investigation. Third on my list is a manager from another department. In other words, the mistake in this particular set of facts that we've presented is that it was the employee's manager who conducted the investigation. If it's going to be internal and you're not going to use counsel or someone from HR, you're going to use a line manager, probably best to use a manager from another department. Then after that, using a manager from the same department, that's what creates problems in this particular case. And in one instance, I was aware of a company that used a lead worker to conduct the investigation. That's probably the worst choice of all. The worker had all kinds of bias and was concerned about all kinds of pressure, and so ultimately that turned out to be a very unreliable investigation. So the very first thing, heading out from getting satisfaction in your investigation, is choosing the right investigator.
Thanks, Steve. So the next set of mistakes that was made in this case involved conducting the investigation and the admonitions that were or weren't given to the various witnesses during the investigation. So you'll remember that when the complainant went to the HR person advised the complainant that the investigation was confidential and that she couldn't discuss it with anyone. And I would say that for the past 20 years that I've been conducting investigations, that was an admonition that was given in virtually every investigation. So most people would say, what's wrong with that? Well, the NLRB has recently decided that telling your employees that they must keep the investigation confidential as a routine matter violates their rights under the NLRA. So you can no longer, and the case is Banner Health Systems, you can no longer tell your employees as a routine matter that they must keep the investigation confidential. Instead, you have to go through an individualized analysis for each and every investigation to determine whether or not there is a particular risk if the investigation is not kept confidential. And I would strongly suggest that if you perform that analysis, you also document that analysis so that you can show that you have determined that there is some particular need to keep the investigation confidential. And in the Banner case, the NLRB specifically said that just protecting the integrity of the investigation is not enough, because obviously that would be invoked in every investigation that you would have. There is some question about the continued viability of Banner, because President Obama's appointments to the board have been questioned and may not be valid, and so all of the decisions that they have promulgated may also not be valid. However, the NLRB is going along as if everything is fine, and in subsequent decisions have affirmed that they're going to be applying Banner.
Well, Kelly, with that, with the factors, don't you have to show that you have a legitimate business interest in maintaining the confidentiality of the investigation? It seems pretty low, that the bar to maintain it.
What you would think
you just
that
have it, to ask and answer the question.
You have to ask and answer the question, but you have to show more than just, well, we're afraid that the investigation will be compromised
right.
if we don't keep this confidential. So you need to have something more than that.
But if you said, well, if everybody found out about it, it would disrupt the workplace.
Sure.
Then you're done. Right, almost done.
That'd be a good start. Okay. I might want to throw in one or two other things.
Okay.
But.
Okay. But it's not like it's a hard.
I don't think it's a high bar. Yeah. I think they want people to be considering it before they give these blanket admonitions. The second problem was that there was an admonition that was not given, and that's the admonition that the witness can't be subject to any sort of retaliation for making the complaint or for participating in the investigation. And that is a routine admonition that you want to give in every case. And also providing witnesses with information regarding what they can do if they feel they've been subjected to any sort of retaliation for participating in the investigation. And you usually want to give them at least one and maybe more than one avenue of redress. If they feel that they've been subjected to retaliation. I usually tell witnesses when I'm conducting an investigation that if they feel they've been retaliated against, they can go to either a designated person inside the company, such as an HR manager, or they can contact me directly. Finally, in this case, you wouldn't give an Upjohn warning because the person who was conducting the investigation, Mike, was not a lawyer. But in cases where you do have a lawyer conducting the investigation, you would want to give your Upjohn admonition advising witnesses that you as a lawyer aren't representing them, but that you would like them to keep your conversation confidential so that you can preserve the attorney-client privilege. Now, I just told you that you can't tell all the witnesses that they have to keep the investigation confidential under Banner. You have to tell them that under Upjohn if you want to preserve the privilege. How Banner and Upjohn will be reconciled certainly has not been decided yet. Upjohn is a Supreme Court case. Banner is an NLRB decision. So it'll be interesting to see going forward how these two things collide, but we don't know that yet. Again, I think making the individualized assessment, giving the confidentiality admonition after you've made that individualized assessment, and then also giving the Upjohn admonition is probably going to be what's going to be the best practice to follow. The next problem that we encounter here is what happened when the witnesses were interviewed. First of all pertinent witnesses should be identified and interviewed. Here, Mike didn't even ask if there were other witnesses, and certainly if he was ever deposed, should this case move forward, he would be criticized for that. In the event that you do ask the question whether there are other witnesses, and many other witnesses are identified, of course, you then have the problem of, do I have to interview each and every one of those witnesses? And I can tell you, having been deposed on this very subject, that if you do not document, first of all, who the other witnesses are who have been identified, but also document why you did or didn't choose to interview those witnesses, that you're going to be subject to some cross-examination, and hopefully your documentation will be sufficient that you can refresh your recollection as to why you didn't interview those witnesses. Because frequently when you ask a complainant, what other witnesses are there? They're going to say, oh, everyone in the department. Everyone in the department knows either what a good guy I am or what a jerk that guy is. And so you're obviously not going to interview everyone else in the department in most cases. It's cost prohibitive. But you want a good record for why you did or didn't interview a particular witness. In addition, Mike didn't interview Rita, the complainant. He simply relied on her written statement and the text messages. In this fact pattern that I actually handled, if Mike had actually interviewed Rita, he would have learned from her that, in fact, although she and Bob had a consensual relationship, that relationship ended over a year prior. And nevertheless, the saucy text messages and requests for sexual favors continued and were at this point in time unwelcome. So you always want to interview the complainant. There are also confidentiality and privacy concerns here. First of all, Mike specifically told Marty about the relationship between Rita and Bob, probably something that Rita didn't want Marty to know, and there was no reason for him to divulge that information. You don't want to be telling your witnesses what the other witnesses in the investigation have said. That compromises the integrity of the investigation and also can lead to some pretty serious morale problems in the workplace. The second problem with privacy and confidentiality that occurred here, actually, this little fact came from the first investigation I ever performed. And it was an investigation involving a fire department. And the allegation was that a certain person was racist, that he had a very large racist tattoo across his back. And because of the confines of a firehouse, people have the opportunity to see each other in various states of undress. And so it was easily believable that if this person had a large racist tattoo across his back, it would, of course, be offensive to the other employees, et cetera. And so I interviewed the alleged racial harasser, who seemed like a very nice gentleman. And during the course of the investigation, I, of course, asked him whether or not he had this large racist tattoo across his back, and he said, absolutely not. He appeared to be shocked. And so I said, would you mind taking off your shirt? And he said, no. He took off his shirt. There was nothing on his back. And you'd think, why would someone make up an allegation that was so easily refutable? But nevertheless, they did. In this case, I varied the fact pattern slightly in that Marty didn't actually want to take off his shirt. And advising an employee during the course of an investigation that they have to disrobe would, of course, implicate that employee's right to privacy. Finally, we have here the issue of the findings that were made. While it's certainly okay in some circumstances to have a non-lawyer conduct your investigation, one of the things I see very frequently as a defense lawyer when a client has made the decision to have a non-lawyer conduct the investigation is that the non-lawyer, not understanding the legal standards, applies them incorrectly and will, especially in the case of harassment, make findings that harassment occurred without understanding that for it to be legally cognizable harassment, it has to be tied to some sort of protected classification. So Mike here made legal findings that harassment and that harassment had not occurred when in fact he didn't have any, he doesn't have the legal background or basis to be able to make those legal findings. And that's why it's important if you're going to be, well, with any investigator, really, the first thing you want to do is define the scope of your investigation. Do you want your investigator to be making legal findings at all? That might be something that you as in-house counsel want to do instead. Sometimes as an outside investigator, I'm asked to make legal findings, and I'll do that. More often than not, I am not asked to make legal findings. I'm asked to make factual findings. And so you want to make it clear to your investigator what it is you expect to see as far as their findings go. Here, we got legal findings when all we should have gotten were factual findings. Your findings should also be based on a preponderance of the evidence standard versus, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt or a clear and convincing standard unless you're investigating fraud. And finally, you don't want your investigator to also be making recommended personnel actions. Here, we have the supervisor of the super salesman who wants to protect his salesman now recommending discipline against the complainant who complained against the super salesman. And that's just a situation that you don't want to find yourself in. So usually recommended personnel actions are not going to be part of your findings.
Okay, we now move to the privilege issue, and certainly attorney-client privilege and attorney work product are considerations that you have to make as in-house counsel. As you probably saw from this fact pattern, there was pretty much no consideration of the privilege in any way, so that would be a big no-no. You want to have a meeting, a thought about it, the general counsel sit down with a few folks that you've had opportunity to investigate for you before and have a plan around that. Once the employer raises the fact that there was an investigation done and we acted upon that investigation and we're using that as a defense, then you've waived your attorney-client privilege and your work product. So you want to think about it ahead of time and take appropriate steps to preserve your privilege all the way through so that at the end of the day, if you feel like as a strategy or let's say you pass it off to a litigator, they can at that point make the decision as to what needs to be done for litigation purposes. And there's just some interesting case law about once the work product privilege is waived and whether the underlying notes are subject to discovery, and you'd like to be able to protect those notes to the extent possible by following some of the guidelines we've been bringing up here. Basically, a company has two options for the investigation documentation. You can apply the privilege, as we've already talked about, and defend the case relying on other things other than the investigation and your findings, or make the decision to waive the privilege and to turn over your investigative report. Again, as I've already said here, it's on the slide, plan for those privileges. Don't just have them happen to you. And have the investigators understand and implement the steps to preserve both privileges. And again, the privilege issue may have some impact on your decision up front as to who is going to do the investigation. And if you're using someone who's not an attorney, or who is a hired professional, you want to have it in your engagement letter that you anticipate that you'll be relying upon their investigation for the purposes of litigation, and that will give you additional protection. Some of you folks who I know I've met and talked to, you know I'm a white-collar criminal defense lawyer, and you're like, what's she doing up there in an employment panel? And that's a semi-good question. However, I have found that now that I am no longer a federal prosecutor and I am actually conducting internal investigations of companies on behalf of the company, that these issues do come up and you need to think about the attorney-client privilege because it also applies in the criminal context and their work product as well. They're a little bit different rules, but it's a universal privilege, and so you need to think about that. And also, in my role with QTAM whistleblower cases, I also represent companies who are having to answer questions from the government about, did you defraud the government? And, well, we don't know. I guess we need to figure that out. So, Zara, come on in and tell us what you think. Or, Zara, go negotiate with the government and try to figure this out. A QTAM can turn into a criminal case. So when you're looking at fraud, and you've had a whistleblower, if you even know you have a whistleblower, sometimes the government doesn't tell you that, you need to think about the privilege really particularly for your company because it has great impact. And at some point, folks may be implicated who will need to get their own independent counsel. And so there's variations, and this isn't really the forum to go into all that other than to say, attorney-client work product issues need to be considered rather than just running off and having the manager conduct an investigation without having those thoughts. And I'm sure all of you sitting here today have probably never made any mistake like that. But that is something to always think about. And we also went into how to protect your privilege. You guys probably all know this, and we really put this together, this PowerPoint, so that you could take it back with you and refresh your memory next time the feds come knocking or you've got a complainant and need somebody to investigate. This can help you with refreshing your memory. But to preserve the attorney-client privilege, the investigator must be acting as an attorney in a capacity which will lead to legal advice as compared to someone giving you business advice. Kelly made a good point as to whether you have, Steve made a good point about whether you have independent counsel and versus your regular counsel. And I think that's a great point as to your regular counsel may be giving you management advice and other advice in addition to legal advice. And maybe this independent counsel is coming in with, you know, no biases, no thoughts about the company or how it's run, and can really give an unbiased, independent opinion and run independently and maybe report back to this council. Yes, I'm still working on things, but they're really separate, and that makes it more clean for attorney-client and work product purposes. The communication must be between the attorney investigator and client. Communication must be made and maintained in confidence. Kelly brought up the great point about Upjohn versus Banner. There may be some interplay there, but if you follow both dictates, I think you'll be fine with maintaining the confidence and preserving the privilege. Also, it has to be prepared and obtained in anticipation of litigation. As I mentioned to you, your engagement letter can say that right there, and it's clear to everybody. We're doing this in anticipation of litigation. Some folks worry about whether there's actually been a lawsuit filed. That's not required. You can have the complaint within the company and say, well, you know, that could lead to litigation. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Also, just a review of things you probably already know, and but just to refresh your memories, for those of you who may have gone to law school about when I went, I found this very helpful, actually, to review these things. And I won't say how long it's been, but it's been a long enough time that I have to look at these things every once in a while. And that's the opinion work product, which is absolutely protected from discovery, unless you waive it. And, of course, you're going to take all kinds of precautions to protect your attorney-client work product. Then there's the factual qualified work product, which the plaintiff can become entitled if he or she can make a showing that there's a need for it and there's no other way to get it. That, when we were talking about the investigation, is the factual investigation that Kelly mentioned. Maybe if you're going into a factual investigation, that could be something that the plaintiff could get a hold of, whereas the opinion work product should not be something that the plaintiff can get a hold of unless you've waived it. Again, opinion work product includes the conclusions, impression, legal theories of an attorney, and when you're writing your investigative report, you should focus on those things to keep it as clean as possible for attorney-client work product purposes.
Zara, can I add?
Yes, sir.
Just wanted to add one quick point for outside counsel who may be representing a company. You may be assuming the person you're working with, it could be the president, it could be the general counsel, could be a senior officer. You're thinking that this person is my client and I'm going to give them my report. And they very much need to understand these rules as well, especially if your client happens to be a foreign company, mm-hmm. like a Japanese company, where we like to take those findings and then we create the longest email list we possibly can to everybody all around the world so that we share in this, so we can all get together and talk about it, although most of those people on that list would not constitute a client under. And so, yeah, I constantly don't give, you know, and sometimes number them. You know, you get report number one, you get report number two, and you get report number three, and don't give it to anybody else without, and they'll ask you later, well, can I give it to so-and-so? And so please help your client help themselves in that way.
You're next.
Actually. I'm next. Okay, great.
Good segue.
Okay, good. Okay, good. Okay, so they give to the in-house guy the section that has little legal substance, and for that I'm very grateful. But, you know, I was listening to this this scenario, and Steve was going through the list of people who can conduct an investigation, and for the in-house counsel and for outside counsel who are advising their companies, I don't know under what circumstance you get past HR professional. I mean, I just can't imagine how that would possibly be. For all those reasons that you stated, but also it gets into this section where you're talking about minimizing disruptions. For being in-house and when you have something bad happen in-house, whether it's fraud or an employment issue or something for which you need an internal investigation, I think the main thing I'd like to just say to everyone is this is a terrible event for your client, for your managers. And we as attorneys like to deal with these situations. And so some of us actually go into these scenarios gleefully. But you've got to understand that this is a really awful thing that's happening to your managers. Their objective is to make money. And they have to make so much money and so much profit, and they can't lose days, they can't lose hours, and they certainly can't lose people. That hurts their ability to perform. And so this is a major disruption for the manager, but it's something that, you know, and they're not professionals. So when you step into an internal investigation, if you stepped in with a game plan, a soup-to-nuts game plan, and offered it to them, they would be very grateful because they have a lot of other things to think about. And if you come in and say, we've got this under control, this is how we propose to do it, you know, your client may have different ideas, but if you have an idea of how to start and stop this thing in as quick a time as possible, then you're going to get a lot of major points. Senior management needs to be involved with very clear and concise communication. And I would suggest that you avoid emails in those situations, even if you're a great email writer. And just sit down with them in a room. And if you have to do it, if you have to say, for the duration of this investigation, I will meet with you every day, sometimes it's every day, at 3 o'clock. And if I have nothing to say, I'll cancel the meeting. And if I have 5 minutes worth of stuff to say, I'll say it in 5 minutes. If I have 2 hours worth of stuff to say, we'll take 2 hours. But they want to know what's happening in a very clear and concise way. And it could be 10 p.m., I mean, whatever you decide. But if you came together with that plan to say, this is when we're going to communicate during the course of this investigation, the client will be quite grateful. The next point is be sympathetic to the business. My boss has told me of the story multiple times, but some of these are kind of silly. You wonder why people do these things. You know, it's like you really did that. Taking nude pictures of yourself and sending them to a coworker. I mean, why? This happened to everybody. We've all dealt with that situation. So obviously, a lot of people are doing this. And so it's worthy of joking around, right? I mean, it's one of the silliest things. You really think girls think that's cool. For some reason, they do. But you got to realize that let your client make the joke. Now, be sympathetic. Be serious. Again, this is like in our organization, we're responsible for the legal health of the companies. That's how we look at it. And so we want to keep every of the companies healthy. When you have a need for an internal investigation, there's obviously a cancer, right? There's a cancer somewhere. And so you're kind of the physician. And they're looking for you to diagnose the situation and then also the surgeon and cut it out. So a serious mind is what they're looking for. But a sympathetic mind as well. If you go in with that attitude, then the senior managers are going to immediately give you credibility. And you have to have that credibility. Because remember, you are disrupting their organization. And we talk about Salesman Bob, right? Salesman Bob may actually be the best salesman they've got. So in their mind, top of their mind, they're thinking, Salesman Bob really screwed up here. But they're also thinking, if Salesman Bob goes, I'm not going to make my numbers, and I'm in trouble. And so you've got to really win those senior managers over to understand that you're sympathetic to that situation because you need their access and you need their support to help them make the right decisions. Operationally, you got to move fast. You've got to move quickly. And until Zara said this was an employment panel, I didn't really know it was an employment panel. But we have a lot of employment situations. But those are actually kind of concise, easy things. But if you have a situation of fraud, you know, you've got to you're going to disrupt the organization, and every day that you wait costs the organization. Every day that you string out the investigation is going to cost the organization. So you've got to be very targeted in your approach, and you've really got to schedule something. And we had a situation in a foreign jurisdiction where we were delivering product to a customer, and we were loading the product. The product was being signed out of our warehouse. The product was being signed into the customer's warehouse and then disappearing. And we had to figure out how that happened. And we had no idea who within, and it required somebody in our organization to participate somehow. And sometimes when it's you have theft within your facility, it's easier, right? Because you say it's missing from this part, and so you can segregate that out. In this situation, we didn't know where this problem stopped. I mean, we didn't know how big the problem was. We knew product was disappearing, so we actually had to go in and within the same day, explain to the manager of the facility that we weren't there for the visit that we explained we were there. We were there for a totally different visit, and that we brought security guards with us to shut down the facility. And everyone who came to work that day had to go sit in the break room, and we had to collect their cell phones. And this was in a foreign. We did check all this stuff out. You could do that. I'm not sure in California whether you can take somebody's cell phone or not. No. We didn't look at it. We just said we wanted everybody. And for 2 days, we conducted investigations, and where we had to pretty much interview everyone. And we had to employ lie detectors. And, that was a big disruption to the organization. We considered it a success because it only took 2 days. But that's 2 days of lost production. But really what was worse with that situation was this was several years ago. There were employees to this day, and there were employees who resigned because of the way they were treated that day. They felt that they were, they were treated like criminals. Unfortunately, there would be no other way to accomplish the task, but you are being disruptive, so be targeted as you possibly can. Predetermine your options. Don't go in and say, we're going to find out everything we can find out, and then we're going to see what we do. I think what's incumbent upon you as the investigator is to go in there and say, okay, if we find out this is going on, you got to tell senior management, if we find out this is going on, these guys are gone. They're going to be terminated, and this is how we're going to do it. Or if these guys are terminated, and we're going to call the police. And these choices have to be made because your conclusions need to be made before 5 o'clock that day. And you need everybody to be ready to pull that trigger because you don't want, you need to close it out as quickly as you possibly can. We've had situations where we've had, in other jurisdictions, where we've had the police waiting in the parking lot for us to make that determination one way or the other. So is that an employment issue? No, I'm not really sure. So you've got to be targeted about it. You've got to predetermine what your options are. Tell them these are the choices, because managers need to understand that. They may say, yes, go investigate and find out, but they need to know that the conclusion possibly is somebody may go to jail, or somebody may be charged with a crime, or somebody may just lose their job. And a lot of these guys may not know that. We had another situation where it was 4 o'clock. Let's see, the shift was over at 4, so it was 3:30. On a Friday afternoon, and a supervisor called us up and says, a piece of equipment is missing, and we think somebody stole it, and we think it's in the trunk of somebody's car, and the shift is going to end in 30 minutes. What do we do? And so in that situation, I did not have we had HR professional, but we also had supervisors. And we got everybody together as they were leaving, and we actually asked them if they would open up the trunk of their car. And I think we have employment policies that would permit that. And under Georgia law, you can do that. Did you know that?
I believe it.
Yes, you can. Yes. That's another great thing about running a manufacturing facility in Georgia, is you actually can. But, you know, another thing about operating a manufacturing facility in Georgia is we don't permit things like firearms on the property. Okay? But if you our question was, the good question somebody asked was, if we open up these trunks and we don't find the saw, but we do find a shotgun, which violates another workplace policy, mm-hmm. what do we do? I think, we had like 5 minutes to make this decision. Maybe it's a good decision, maybe it's a bad decision, but we basically just said, if you don't find a body, close it up. if you find a body, give us a call, and we'll decide what to do from there. And luckily there was, the saw was, somebody moved it. And then nobody had stolen the saw, and nobody really cared because it was Friday afternoon, and they were like, oh, look at my trunk. Fine, I want to get out of here. So it really wasn't a problem in that situation. But you got to watch your option. If you find something else, what are you going to do? The final point is you've got to move quickly. Really try to close these things by the end of the day. Stories are going to change overnight. Stories are going to change overnight completely. So if you're going to start, you better be ready to stop that day. Bring enough people with you, enough guns with you to close it up. Another real important thing is if you do act, pull all the employees together who may be involved or who see what's going on or notice a lot of people going into rooms and, people leaving crying. Explain to the employees what happened, to the extent you can, that actions were taken and why. That's really important for to get everybody back to a place of successful operation. Next one is containing costs, right? Yeah, set budgets. Time is as much as money. I think with your investigations, you're going to say, I'm going to go in heavy and get in and get out. It may involve some surveillance. It may involve security in certain situations. Make sure you've got those guys covered. Sometimes when you're addressing employees or interviewing employees, you may want to have additional security waiting nearby. In some cases, you want security sitting next to you. And then also, a lot of times we are, because investigations don't permit a lot of planning time, you may go with name brand investigators, and we have in the past, and we have, we can rack up $100,000 in investigator bills in no time. But there are a lot of great investigators, in Mexico, in Honduras, in El Salvador, United States, and Canada that are much, much cheaper than some of the name brands. And I would recommend shopping for those guys in advance. Also, talk to your insurance company. Or explain to your client to go talk to their insurance company as soon as possible, because certain expenses, investigatory expenses, may be covered by their insurance policy. However, if the insurance policy doesn't like your investigator, they may very well deny those expenses. So if you've got somebody that you want to use, call your insurance, tell your client to call the insurance company and tell them this is what you're planning on doing. I say name brands can be expensive. I think, who's used a forensic accountant here before? I mean, those guys are really expensive. So, and there are smaller firms out there that have a lot of great forensic accountants.
And, Jim, I know that a lot of forensic accounting firms are now also hiring and having on board these forensic IT people who can go in. I had to have a situation where I had to have somebody's cell phone, but they wouldn't give it up at all. So the forensic IT person sat there with the guy, with his cell phone, with an external hard drive, plugged it in, was able to download the entire contents of the phone, give the guy back his phone, and then go on his merry way. So those are becoming, I think.
That guy was a great, but that guy was $1,000, right? That was a $1,000 pull.
It was well over that. Yeah.
But worth it.
But
worth it if you can do that. Okay, good. Excellent. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and especially when you've got these fraud situations. With fraud, I tell folks in our organization, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And the second question is, for how long have they been doing it? It's not when will they, when did they start, and for how long have they been doing it? And I think with crime in the workplace, something like 66% is coming out of your accounting department. Your IT guys may very well be part of that deal, right? Because IT guys are getting paid by the hour. And so if an accountant is, and these accountants who steal are extremely intelligent. I mean, if you thought if they could just put some of that energy towards solving problems in your company, you'd be a very well-run company. But these guys are geniuses, and they're smart enough to get people, other people involved. So, yeah, outside IT forensic specialists would be critically important in a lot of these situations. Yeah. And the last point is just do what you can in-house, but get out of the way if you don't know what you're doing. Oh, I'm still going, right?
Still
implementing
going.
Solutions. Okay. All right. If you can go in there and talk about a solution afterwards, your client will be much very grateful, okay? A lot of times your client's going to say, do I have to really get rid of Bob? And yes, you have to get rid of Bob. That's what they want to hear from you. They do not want to hear, well, maybe, well, you could do this. Here are your options. They're going to say, no, you need to get rid of Bob. This is a risk you do not need to take. You need to get rid of Bob. No matter how disruptive, messing around, letting that cancerous cell remain within the organization, if you suspend them or re-educate them or retrain them, all those nice things we talk about, you're still going to have problems later on. You've got to get rid of Bob. Immediately perform the root cause analysis because, you know, if you've got a problem, especially with fraud, it's going to be a multitude of problems that you've got to handle. You know, segregation of duties is going to be immediate. Are your managers actually looking at the numbers the way they were supposed to look at the numbers? And so if you could go in there and implement solutions, it would be a series of solutions. Not just getting rid of Bob, but you've got to do these other things as well. You don't have enough people in your accounting department, or you need to reinforce your managers to not ask their subordinates to go out on dates with them. You know, there's lots of things you need to do across the board, and if you could provide the solutions to make sure that this event and events like it don't happen again, then your clients will be quite grateful. That's it.
All right. We're coming to a conclusion here. In order to have satisfaction with this investigation, you want to make sure that it can stand up, ultimately that it'll stand up whether you have to go to an arbitration or litigation or even if it's just a deposition. And so I'd like you to think about the answers that Mike might give to some of these questions. Mike, isn't it true that you've had no training in conducting investigations? That's not an answer that you're going to want to hear, I'm afraid, where Mike is the manager. In particular, again, looking sort of back at the retention of an investigator, you want whoever it is who's going to be answering that question about prior training to be able to respond that they are aware, particularly if it's a case involving harassment or discrimination, that they are aware of the EEOC guidelines regarding conducting such investigations. If they have a blank stare on their face and they don't know anything about those conducting those kinds of investigations, that's going to be a problem.
Or they've never heard of the EEOC. Or
that's a problem too. If you are like most people, you'd say, well, I've never heard of these guidelines. Where do I find those guidelines? They are available from the EEOC. The place to find them online is at www.eeoc.gov/policy/docs/harassment.html. That's where you'll find them. Now, if you go to that site, you'll look at it and you'll say, what does this have to do with guidelines for this? This is about supervisor liability. You have to look way down inside of it at subsection Roman 5 in subsection C, subsection 1, and there you'll find the guidelines. And surprisingly, what you'll see in those guidelines includes things like particular questions that you're supposed to ask to various witnesses. What questions should you be asking to the alleged perpetrator? What questions should you be asking to the victim? What questions should you be asking to others? And in particular, a mention was made, if they're going to conduct an analysis, whoever is going to do the analysis for you, they should be able to identify the five criteria set out by the EEOC that are required to determine a person's credibility. Just to quickly, the inherent plausibility, demeanor, motive to falsify, corroboration, and past record. If your investigator doesn't have a clue about those things, you know you're going to be in trouble. All right. Just some other questions that might be problematic. Mike, isn't it true that you've never conducted an investigation like this before? Oh, lack of experience, complete lack of experience. That can be a problem as well. And Mike, isn't it true that every time you've conducted one of these investigations, it's always turned out favorable to the employees in your department? Oh, that can be a problem as well. You want to be able to demonstrate that the person who's conducting the investigation has some experience, some valid experience. Another point is bias. You want to be concerned about any demonstration of bias. Do they have a relationship with one of the people involved in the investigation? That's clearly going to be a problem. Do they have an interest in the outcome? Here in this case, Mike had an interest in the outcome of the investigation. And in some instances, you want to be careful about personal bias as well. Do they have a particular concern? All right. Finally, you got to be concerned about questions, ultimately cross-examination questions that have to do with the actual conduct of the investigation itself. Did they, as was mentioned earlier, did they talk to all the witnesses, or did they identify at least who all the witnesses were, and have they done the things necessary in order to demonstrate that the investigation was conducted according to standards?
And I just had one last point that I had thought of. It kind of segues into our next presentation, so we'll just make mention of it. This is something that lawyers don't normally have to do, which is deal with the press. And the next panel will be talking about that. But that often comes up, especially with my experience in the white-collar criminal defense area. And you need to have somebody in your Rolodex that you can rely upon for help in that area. And also listen to the next panel, and I'm sure they're going to have some great comments about that as well. But especially, you know, companies that are well-known in certain areas, anything that goes on at those companies is big news. So you also have to keep that in mind as you're going through and getting rid of the cancer.
So as a takeaway, we've prepared an investigation checklist. I think the best plan of action is to have a plan of action. So if you follow the checklist, you follow the steps, and you can look back and satisfy yourself, and hopefully you won't ever have to satisfy a jury, that your investigation was thorough, complete, objective, and fair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a 15-minute break, but three quick announcements. If you need CLE credit, the CLE book is on the registration table, so just make sure you sign that before you leave. We also, during the reception, we've arranged for you all to be able to tour the aquarium, and you need a wristband to do that, and we're going to have those at the registration table as well. And lastly, we're going to do a drawing for five 100 Visa gift cards, $100 Visa gift cards. And we're going to do that right at the beginning of the reception. So there's a bowl out on the table. Just drop a business card if you haven't done that yet. Thanks.